Good morning, friends. As I look out into the congregation, there are so many of you that I have come to meet and know over the 21 years that I've been a member here at First Church, 14 of which have been as administrative assistant in the church office, and I feel so blessed to be here. I welcome also my sister, one of my sisters, Tricia, and her dear friend, Ray. So welcome. Good to have you here. I love stories. I love to hear them. I love to hear your stories when I get the chance. And I love to share mine. Back in 2013, in the United Church of Christ Connecticut Conference publication Contact, our conference minister, Reverend Kent Salati, did an article about telling our stories. And here is just a little bit of what he had to say in that publication. We have stories to tell. It's the story of our lives. We are all experts in the narratives unfolding of our experiences, our emotions, relationships and perspective by which we view God's world. And then he goes on to say, we have stories to tell of churches making a difference. We have stories to tell of resilience in overcoming great challenges. Ancient people knew the power of stories. They sat around campfires and passed them on from one generation to another. End of quote. The Bible tells us a lot about faith, hope, and love. We see Jesus welcoming the outcasts, healing the sick, restoring people spiritually wherever he went. We read about some great people like Noah, who found favor in God's eyes. Noah was asked to build an ark. He didn't understand it, but he built an ark on dry land. And then God asked him to do something, which was hard to understand as well. He asked him to wait and wait and wait until the floods came. And Noah was faithful, and he obeyed God, and he was spared, and his family and the animals. And then there's Job in the Bible. He suffered so much. He lost his children, his health, his livestock, his crops. And yet he persevered through those trials, and he humbled himself before God and remained faithful. So, what about my story? Well, it's an immigrant story. It's about the hopes and dreams of my parents coming to this country for a better life for us. It begins in Bosnia, in what was the country of Yugoslavia at one time, in a little village called Lesnja. And the second part of my story, the latter part, takes place starting in 1991, when I went through one of the hardest transitions in my life. My world was kind of turned upside down, and I was questioning my faith. And by the grace of God, I came through actually with a stronger sense of God's amazing love during those times. Growing up, I often heard my mother talk about my grandparents and my great-grandparents and what life was like for them. And it made them come alive in my memory, and it also connected me to our family's history. I know that my grandparents emigrated from the shifting borders of Ukraine to Austrian Poland, or Galicia, as it was called back then, and later to Yugoslavia in the early 1900s. I begin with this photo. With the world at war, my parents married in November of 1941 under very poor conditions in the village church in Lisnja, Bosnia, an area surrounded by Croatia and Serbia. My mother, Evgenia, was one of seven children. My father was one of nine children. Conditions during those World War II years and following had not changed much in the country, and it had often been very hard for people to have enough food to eat as they lived off the land. There was no prenatal care or hospital care in that area, so it would have been devastating, even life-threatening, for a woman giving birth if complications arose in a home delivery. So it was indeed a very joyous occasion when a child came through a home delivery, healthy and wailing with its first breath. I was given the name of Katerina, and as was the custom, I was baptized 3 days later in that little church. Our house stood on a hilltop surrounded by acres of farmland. It contained nothing more than a pantry, a kitchen, a sleeping area in one room, and a second room for sleeping as well. We used the old wood stove for cooking and heating. And while Americans enjoyed modern technology during those post-war years, electrical power lines had not yet reached our area. So here's a house with no television, no radio, no microwave, no click of the switch for electricity. There was no plumbing, so there was no bathroom or wash machine. Doing laundry meant filling a large wash tub with water drawn from the well and then heating it on the stove. Nothing was wasted, neither food nor clothing. Scraps of fabric taken from worn clothing was often pieced together to serve yet another purpose. Beds piled high with hand-sewn feather comforters kept us warm during the winters. And this photograph shows the materials with which the house was made: mud, straw, and stones to fill. I took this photograph when I went back in 1984. People walked from place to place. It wasn't unusual for my mother, my father, my sister Helen, my brother Steve, and I to walk a kilometer each way to church on Sunday mornings or holy days of obligation. I often carried my sandals and walked barefoot. They were my only shoes until they worn out or no longer fit. The church building wasn't much more than an oversized room. An old wooden cross rested outside its only door. And typically characteristic of European Eastern Rite churches, hand-painted icons adorned its walls. Since there were no pews or chairs, we stood during the Mass about an hour, maybe more. Attending church was an important part of everyone's life, providing a place of spiritual nourishment and sustaining us, helping us to go on. Everyone took part in worship, young and old. Set prayers were learned as soon as the child could talk. Incense often filled the church. Beautiful songs of praise came from each person rather than a choir. A harmony of favorite hymns transformed that rustic old church into a place of reverence. We were on holy ground. The route to America was my father's dream. In the spring of 1951, as a four-year-old, I sat on my father's lap for a rare family photograph. At the time, of course, I'm sure I didn't understand any of it. Where was he going? What was this place called America? How long would he be gone? When would we see him again? Being unschooled at the time, I had no concept of the world around me. So at the young age of 31, he set out for America. Being sponsored by his brother already settled here in Glastonbury, He was given a rental apartment and found work as a stonemason at a construction job in Hartford. And he saved whatever money he could to be able to send for my mother, my sister, brother, and I. After only 1 year, he had saved enough money to begin the process of sending for us. The preparations at our end began: a visa, passport, medical examinations, and inoculations. Within another year, in 1953, the day of our departure from Bosnia brought my grandmother and my mother's siblings together. My mother is the, well, she was the second one. She is the second one from the right. And if you saw the picture closer, you could just see the sadness of leaving her mother and her family behind. And here's another picture of our departure. And the thatched roof of our house is in the background. And this photograph also captures the sadness of saying goodbye, with my grandmother in the center and my mother behind her and my sister and brother and I. And that was our final goodbye. The ride out of the village was a bumpy one as we traveled in my uncle's horse-drawn wagon to a train station hours away. From there, the train traveled north to the town of Trieste on the Italian border, then to a shipping port in Genoa, Italy. Our journey continued on the Conte Biancamino for 12 days across the Atlantic Ocean towards America. Our quarters were located in a lower deck with bunk beds as our temporary beds, and so my eyes became accustomed to seeing the billowing waves through the portholes of that deck, of that room. How vast the ocean must have seemed to me as I turned 6 on the ship. How difficult it must have been for my mother, leaving her family behind, 3 children by her side, 1 suitcase, and not knowing a word of English, not knowing Italian, which were spoken on the ship 12 days. How she must have trusted God. As we approached New York, I remember to this day standing on the deck with everyone else with all the excitement. I remember seeing the Statue of Liberty, the torch held high. It meant tears of joy to so many people, and especially to my parents. They had not seen each other for 2 years, and again, if the picture was, if you can see the joy in their face, just to be together again. And then I'm looking at that picture, what was I saying to my little brother? May 11th, 1953 is a day I will never, ever forget. Life from that day on would never be the same for me. Little did I know the changes that would happen in my life in a land that had so much to offer. We settled in a 3-room, 3rd-floor attic apartment here in Glastonbury on Grove Street, just around the corner from where Ace Hardware is. And it was walking distance to Main Street, and it was across the street from St. John the Baptist Ukrainian Catholic Church, which still stands. Now it's New London Turnpike. It was relocated. It was the only building, when they went through redevelopment in 1972, the only building that was moved, and it still stands there. There was never enough room, but we took everything in stride, and we appreciated the furniture and everything that people gave us at that time. The turn of a black and white television knob opened my eyes wide to a whole new world. It became my primary source of not only entertainment, but for learning the language. So here it was May, and I was going to start school, first grade at Academy School in September. I began to slowly make friends, and my shyness eventually gave way as I joined in fun games like hide and seek, red light, Simon Says. There were coloring books and crayons, paper dolls, hula hoops, riding a bicycle, all so new to me. I was in a whole new world, new things like eating a juicy orange or an ice cream cone, potato chips, hot dogs, French fries. Oh my goodness. How could I ever imagine watching a full screen movie in a theater, or attending a circus, or fireworks on the 4th of July? I had suddenly awakened to a child's dream of tastes, sights, and sounds much too wonderful to be true. As I began first grade, my name was changed from Katharina to Catherine. It's American version, after all. I was in America. Within a year, our family began to grow, and we would become a family of six, still living in a three-room, third-floor attic apartment on Grove Street. My parents were strict religious people, both quickly became involved in St. John the Baptist Ukrainian Catholic Church, my father helping with the grounds. And since the church was across the street, we often tagged along. So there we are in our best clothes, right? In some ways, we were a typical family in Glastonbury in the mid-1950s. My father was the breadwinner, the one who worked and provided for us. My mother was the homemaker, the foundation holding us together and nurturing us. What held steady in her life was the strength of her faith. It had often been common to see her hands folded in prayer as she began or ended her days. Each Sunday we attended church. Each morning and night we knelt by our beds and said our prayers. We respected our elders and we did what was expected. For the longest time, I believed if I behaved a certain way and was good, that nothing bad would happen. Needless to say, despite playing by the rules, however, I later learned of disillusionment when things unraveled within our family, and my handsome father turned more and more to alcohol following burns he sustained in a gas explosion at a work site. And then he died several years later at the age of 55. 9 years after his death, no matter how hard I may have tried to prepare myself for someday to lose my mother, I was not prepared at all when she died in 1983 at the age of 60. Acting on a yearning to return to the land of my roots a year after her death, I did something I never thought I could do. I had never been on a plane before, so the thought of flying over the ocean for 6 hours or so just frightened me. And I'm thinking back, maybe it had to do with watching the waves through the portholes when I was 6 years old. It must have been embedded in my head or something, but scared stiff to fly. But I knew I had to go. And it was as if I felt my mother's gentle spirit telling me that it would be all right, that I needed to go. And there's no doubt in my mind today that, my sister Mary, who was born in this country, also went back with me to Yugoslavia. So there's no doubt in my mind today as I took one look at the decrepit condition of the Yugoslav airplane before boarding, and as I attempted to understand the flight attendant's instructions in broken English, oh my gosh, can't believe I did it. My return to the back rows of my native village as an adult reconnected me with my relatives back in Bosnia, including my uncle who had taken us to the train station and set us on our journey to America in 1953. And that's my uncle's wagon that we were on, but I told my sister that's certainly not the same horse 30-something years later. My return is a trip I will never forget. Spending 3 weeks, what was I saying to that? Oh my gosh. My return for 3 weeks is a trip I will never forget. As there was so much singing and telling stories and dancing with the family, overflowing with so much love. All family. I'll never forget. I was an educated American girl living in a nearly idyllic American town, Glastonbury. Graduated from Glastonbury High School, married, and became a mother of two sons, working part-time at a law firm, driving to soccer meets and ice hockey tournaments, band concerts and birthday parties. I must have been trying to be a super mom, I think. And striving to live a good life, I learned early on to overlook the not so good things. I absorbed myself more and more in a marriage that was falling apart, hoping that by keeping myself busy, that the wrinkles would flatten themselves out. And when they did not, I just tried harder and harder to ignore them. And little by little, bitterness set in. Little by little, my soul began to lose ground, and my relationship with God became clouded as I felt more and more distant. The turmoil would not end, and as a divorce process continued, I thought surely God had abandoned me. I was in limbo, searching for answers. After all, it meant letting go of my identity. It meant stepping into the insecurity of the unknown future. A big part of me kept wrestling with God, insisting, "This is not the way it's supposed to be." My prayers began to pour out from my heart as I earnestly prayed for courage and strength. Relying on my faith more than ever, I tried to remember the promise that God's goodness would prevail. I had to believe that. Then in 1992, quite unexpectedly, I ran into a family friend I hadn't seen for a while. And as he and I sat and chatted, I remember him saying, "Kathy, I know of a supportive singles group that meets at a church near the center of Glastonbury. Why don't you go? You might find it helpful." Well, anyone that knows me knows I'm stubborn, and I just put it off thinking that I could somehow do it all on my own, face the challenges ahead of me. But no, after a couple of weeks, I did attend, and that was the beginning. God was about to take the struggles of my life and change it. It was a typical Wednesday evening at First Church in 1992 when the singles ministry met in Schultz Hall, a ministry that focused on the spiritual and emotional growth of single adults of all ages, many faith backgrounds. Sitting in Schultz Hall with about 100 people that evening, I felt welcomed in and just listened. At the end of the evening, the minister closed with a prayer. And as I closed my eyes and heard that prayer, it was as if I felt every word with such intensity, it gave me hope and assurance that I no longer had to carry my struggles alone. I returned week after week and slowly began to connect more and more with the topics that were being discussed, topics about grief, topics about letting go, about prayer, about taking care of yourself. In time, things began to fall into place and changes began to take hold in my life. Didn't happen overnight. and striving to find the best place to grow in my spiritual journey then, I found myself slowly letting go of the little Ukrainian Catholic church here in town, church that I grew up in, the church that my sons had been altar boys in, the church that had nurtured us all those years. It became obvious to me that I needed to change churches, but how would I find that peace as I wrestled in making that break? And going back one last Sunday there, I knew what I needed to do. And the friends, dear friends, the rest is history. I found that the hope God gives us is not that life will be easy or free of sorrow, but that God is with us every step of the way. It doesn't depend on everything turning out the way I expect if I do this or if I do that. I found it's more about enduring during those times, trusting that God will show a way out or he will show us a way through, that we are not alone. In closing, I am blessed to be here, so thankful for the opportunity to share my story with you. In 2001, after 5 years of writing and editing, I published a book, Remembering the Gift, copies of which are available in the Narthex if you'd like to take one. I believe we share a bond here at First Church, a commitment and a purpose that unites us. We sing together, pray together, we bless one another, hug and console one another. We hold one another up when times are hard, and we celebrate when times are good. In 1996, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, so I am a 20-year ovarian cancer survivor. And during that time, 1996, First Church just rallied around me. So many people were there for me. I am so appreciative to Barbara Thompson and many others who visited or sent cards or brought meals to the home. So big church, First Church had a big part in that. I'm so grateful. And I end with this. In a worship bulletin a few weeks ago, the following words were the words of meditation written by William Sloan Kaufman, which I'd like to end with here. If Christ is God's love in person on earth, churches ought to be God's love in an organization on earth. If love is what it's all about, where are we going to celebrate that love unless in a community of loving people? Essentially, what a church ought to be is a community of loving people who believe that our lives consist of an abundance of love. Amen.